I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 6 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, and hopefully all week, is Jim O'Kane, the grand poobah of the MXM community. Welcome back, Jim.
One of the poobahs. No, thanks for having me on again, Rob.
You have a lot of poobahs, but there's just one grand poobah, you know.
I'll have just my cap with the buffalo horns on it.
There you go. You look like Fred or Barney. Which one do you think you look more like?
Oh gosh, I definitely have the Barney body. It's just kind of square. Usually wearing just it's serrated, just so I can just slide into it. I'm built for comfort, not speed.
Okay.
Wow. I do want to apologize to your audience about my voice. I have my typical seasonal allergies coming in, so I've got all kinds of allergy meds, and if I sound a little baritone, that's usually not me. But
your voice is okay as long as you still are able to bring, you know, the trivia and info. That's what you're here for.
The things that do me no good, yes.
No, the only things that do that are only good for shows like this. You know,
that's right, yes.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, yeah. Something to listen to on the treadmill. Here we are.
Yeah, so many different things it could be. All right, so minute 6 begins with George saving Harry and ends with Violet greeting George and Mary in the soda shop. So wow. We ended things on Friday with, you know, it was a little bit of a cliffhanger because, you know, Harry falls through the ice and we're listening to the narration and we're hearing, you know, Joseph and Clarence talking about what's going on, or Joseph is more or less explaining to Clarence what's going on. Now, do you have any, I'm actually going to backtrack a little bit. Do you know the names of the two angels or heavenly bodies? There's Joseph. And do you remember the other one?
No, because I just remember Clarence yelling, Joseph, Joseph.
That's right. No, because he only talks to Joseph after the first week. We only get Joseph. But the other one's name is Franklin. So last week, Jay and I were trying to figure out, you know, where these names came from, because only the voice actor who does the voice of Franklin is even listed. He's uncredited, but he's the only one who's listed on IMDb. We don't have anyone, you know, for the Joseph. And we were trying to think of it, and we actually think we might have figured out, you know, that Franklin is Frank Capra, and Joseph is one of the writers. There were a whole bunch of credited writers. One of them is Joe Swerling.
Okay, that would make sense.
So, I mean, it's an educated guess. You know, I couldn't find any real proof of this. But it would sort of make sense that, you know, Capra thinks of himself, you know, he's going to place himself as the higher angel, I guess you can say.
Yeah, the omniscient, less talking one. Yeah. So kind of
the omniscient, sit back and watch it. Less talking one that one of the things we discussed last week was, if he knew that this was going to be George's day, why didn't they start, you know, telling Clarence this story, you know, earlier? Why wait until we have an hour left?
Yeah, he didn't really flesh out the rules enough.
No.
It's enough to do exposition.
Yes. Yes. But it's still nice the way that he did it.
Yeah.
So last week we ended on the cliffhanger with George jumping into the ice cold, you know, broken, or the ice cold water from the broken ice. And, you know, then George and his friends all create a chain in order to pull Harry and George out of, you know, this little predicament.
And yeah, they're very well equipped for this too. I mean, it's like they form a little conga line there, and they all seem to know what their role is in it. So apparently, they've had lots of kids falling into ponds.
Well, you think that if they're in that area and they're sliding down on shovels, they must be aware that this could happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we noticed last week there's also a sign that said this is property, that the property that they're doing this on is actually Potter's property.
Ah.
And in one of the older versions of the script, Potter actually chases them away. And that's what, and that's how Harry gets killed, you know, in the alternate world or alternate version, however you want to call it. You know, I'm just going to refer to it as the Biff Tannen version of
the Eric Stoltz of, yeah.
Okay, you could also use the Eric Stoltz aspect of also. But I love the fact that you can, that basically Back to the Future 2 mirrors It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not something you would have thought of. I mean, apparently Zemeckis and Bob Gale and whoever I'm trying to remember who the third, I don't remember who the third one was. Apparently they thought of it. Yeah, so why not?
Wow. Yeah. We finished through that nice, beautiful 1940-ish wipe. I love wipes more than just, you know, cuts or dissolves and stuff. So it's a nice optical print there that it takes it across 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 frames. So it's just a nice, beautiful sweep as we get rid of the action and throw it into it goes from winter to springtime when George gets healed.
That's right. And we actually get the narration from Joseph saying George saved his brother's life that day, but he caught a bad cold, which infected his left ear, cost him his hearing in that ear. It was weeks before he was able to go back to his after-school job at Old Man Gower's drugstore. You know, and as this narration is going by, I mean, first of all, it's great that within just seconds, they're able to tell us, you know, he got sick, lost his hearing, had a few weeks vacation, and then, you know, he was fine to go back to work. And now we know where he's working and all that stuff. It's very concise the way that they explain this to us.
Yeah, think about how many shots they saved there rather than having to show it. They did tell, and, you know, it's people usually say show it, don't tell it, but it really was a great economy in this movie that you get through all those things, and it really wasn't important to the plot. You know, they just explained this is what happened. This is a major event in his life, and now we just go through the synopsis and we get up to the next significant chapter.
Right, that's true. But do you know, is it possible for someone to lose their hearing from just getting an infection?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, you could rupture your eardrum and cause nerve damage as well. There's, you know, there's the three tiny bones in your ear could be you know, inflamed and fall out of adjustment. And we have to look at the time. It's 1919. They're not at the medical levels that we are a century later. So it's like your hearing's gone. Sorry, that's all she wrote. They didn't really have lots in the way of antibiotics. Penicillin wasn't even around at the time.
Right.
So it's I mean, he's lucky to have lived.
That's
especially
right.
As we're talking as we'll get to later in this episode about you know, what's going on in the world.
That's right. But basically, I mean, I looked it up. And so most ear infections don't cause long-term complications. Sometimes you can have ear infections that will recur, and those can lead to serious complications. And one of those complications is impaired hearing. Mild hearing loss that comes and goes is fairly common when someone has multiple ear infections, but it usually gets better after the infection clears up. Ear infections that happen over and over, or if you have fluid in the ear, could lead to more significant hearing loss. And sometimes there can be permanent damage to the eardrum or other middle ear structures, which could cause permanent hearing loss at that point. So I guess that's what happened. I mean, it's pretty interesting because, like, why do you think they need this in the plot? There's really no place in the plot except for later on when he says, "Now I can hear." That's it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the other.
No, you have Mary. Okay. With Mary, you will say.
But also he, he didn't participate in World War II. He couldn't be a hero like Harry because he was 4F.
Ah, okay.
Because he was deaf in one ear. So that's a significant thing that kept him. Once again, he wasn't, he wasn't in the Pacific War. He wasn't in the in Europe, and he missed out on the I don't say adventure, the greatest thing, this world changing event that happened, and he was sitting at home running the
building
the allotments and rationing. Yeah,
right.
So it wasn't where where he wanted to be at any time. He didn't have to travel
anywhere. All right, you're right about that. I forgot about that particular point. I guess they needed to find a way to make him 4F. It's an interesting choice to make him that he's deaf in one ear.
And it's brilliant. And it's just this economy of where we're seeing things. And this probably would have meant more to people at the time. If you saw somebody who was, deaf in one ear, you thought, oh, they sat out the war. But he has a reason. He wasn't, he wasn't like shirking his responsibilities. I mean, he really couldn't do much.
Right. And we also know from history that there were a lot of people during World War II that if they were considered 4F, there were a lot of cases of people who committed suicide because they weren't able to go, join the war effort.
Yeah. I mean, and, you think about other plots that relied on this, like Captain America.
Right.
Here we are.
He didn't have hearing problems, though. He was just scrawny. No, that's true. He was just scrawny.
He was just built like like young George Bailey, only he was like in his 20s. Here George missed out on World War I because he was too old. It was 1919, and he just missed the first war.
Right.
And so he's just been kind of shut out of everything.
You're not going to send a 12-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, interesting time here. This is a fascinating little change as we get to 1919. There's a rather famous pair of pictures of New York, because we see the world is changing in front of them. There's a famous pair of pictures. One was taken in 1903 on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, and there was another one taken in 1913 of Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. In 1903, the picture shows a street full of horses, carriages, wagons, and one single horseless carriage, an automobile. 10 years later, jumping to 1913, there's a famous picture with all these automobiles and one horse and wagon in the entire stretch of Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And here we're seeing the Model T, following up behind the boys who are completely clogging the street.
Yes.
and we see Old Man Potter, who refuses to change with the times. He's got his, as the angels are talking to each other, he's driving by like a king in his royal carriage from another age.
That's right. Still with horses and stuff like that. It's like he's still king of the castle.
Yeah, and he's the only horse on the street, so he's not prone to change. But it's an interesting. It sets the tone. This is the first reveal of Lionel Barrymore there.
That's right.
And as Potter, Old Man Potter.
Yeah, and I love the fact that it's George who shouts out to everyone, "Hey, it's Potter. It's Mr. Potter."
Yeah.
Because of all of his interaction, he's the only one actually who's going to have interactions with Potter throughout the movie. Of these six kids that are there. I mean, Harry never has any connection to him, and neither do Marty or Sam. We don't know the names of the other two friends that are there, but and it's great how we still have the voiceover between Clarence and Joseph, and then Clarence goes, "Who's that? A king?" And Joseph responds, "That's Harry F. Potter, the richest and meanest man in the county." Which you'd think that the angel is supposed to, or the heavenly body, however you want to refer to it, is supposed to be, a little more unbiased, obviously they're telling us that this is a mean guy.
Yeah. Let me give you their character traits so you don't have to figure it out for yourself.
That's right. Which we'll figure it out over the course of the next few days anyway, but still, and I've always loved the fact, at least for the last 20 plus years, that Henry Potter is basically Harry Potter. Ooh, you know, Henry and Harry are the same name.
Yeah.
So
I wonder what the F stands for. But I think a lot of people in town already know his middle name. So it's
we're trying to be family friendly, so we shouldn't say
it. Obviously it's Finnegan.
Finnegan Begin Again.
It's so intriguing that Potter doesn't even look out the window. He doesn't, you know, the people around here are just his. They're basically the renters that pay for his houses. So why does he care about what's going on in town?
That's right.
All the boys have been looking around town, seeing what's going on. They know the score of what's going on out there.
Yeah, I love how he has his initials engraved on the side of the carriage. Says HP.
Yeah.
You can't be more vain than that. Yeah.
Yeah, all that pinstriping and everything and the multitude of little gold buttons and such.
Yeah.
So you instantly, I mean, in that one shot, you get a measure of the man immediately.
That's right.
Wow. And then we,
you now, know, when, we are when, now. Before we jump ahead, what okay. We'll find this information out later in this week. But, you know, obviously the beginning of this minute happens in the winter. Okay. So it must be, January, maybe February, but probably January. Right. And then it takes them just a few weeks because, you know, if you got all this ice.
Well, there's contention as to where this is taking place. Town of Seneca Falls.
It's in New York.
Well, yeah, but I know that the town of Seneca Falls claims that it's
it was based on them.
It's the real bet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I grew up in what New York City dwellers call upstate, but it was actually Westchester and Putnam counties in New York, just north of New York City, mm-hmm. and. I used to take the Harlem Division Line train to Brewster, New York every night. And name of it, who, by the way, happens to be the name of another Capper property, the Brewster family in Arsenic and Old Lace.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to travel every night through Bedford Hills and Croton Falls. And if I know that Frank Capra never really was a New Yorker, he went straight to Los Angeles. But I think Robert Riskin had some background in New York, and I thought, well, if he's putting together pieces, he might have known the Harlem division of the New York Central Railroad and looked at the sign that said Bedford Hills, Croton Falls. Why don't we just call it Bedford Falls?
Right.
So I'm assuming this is late in the year where it might have been. I used to skate on a little lake called Tenetta Lake, and you could skate there as late as the end of February, the beginning of March, but you were taking your life in your hands. So I'm just wondering if
maybe the reason that the ice was thin is because it was later in the season.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's later in the season. And as we come across, I don't want to jump ahead, but we will get an exact date
correct.
When all this is That's happening right. a little bit later.
Right. But you also see that the boys are all carrying, when they're walking, with the arms clasped together, you see they have baseball equipment with them.
So it's already ready for spring.
That's right. It's already spring, April, May, something like that. So that means that George was out of commission probably for about 2 months, based on what they're saying here. Even though they say a few weeks, it was weeks before he was able to go back to work. But the assumption is that basically, he's this is early to mid spring. We'll find out later this week exactly the exact date. Which again, there's a little bit of a continuity error about that later on in this week also, about when we're talking.
Yeah,
about.
And we do notice. I mean, he's still recuperating because all the other boys have some kind of piece of baseball gear. They're carrying mitts. They're carrying bats. George is carrying a rolled up magazine in his pocket. So, which I think would indicate that while he was recuperating, he couldn't do anything much but read. So he just developed while everything else was going on and he was hearing people, having fun as spring was arriving, he may have heard people planting their gardens or, kids calling down saying, hey, it's dry. Let's go over to the ball game. This might have been one of the, the first week after he's been out of bed.
Could be. Because also, if you look, they're all of them are dressed in baseball uniforms except for George. He's the only one, but he's also on his way to work. So
yeah, exactly. He doesn't have time for this when he's, you know, he's got a job to do.
Maybe they're so, all off to the diamond and they're dropping him off at work, you know, on the way.
Yeah.
You know, it could be that also because at this point, you know, they basically bring him to the entrance of the drugstore and they sort of flip him in the way that which is very interesting to watch.
Well, and that comes from, at least on ice skating, when I was a kid out on the lake, that's called crack the whip. And the kid at the end, you'd swing him around, and being the furthest out, all that angular momentum would go to the kid on the end. So they just flip them out in the same way that you do it on the ice. He's back. except instead of, you know, zipping across the ice, he goes zipping into the drugstore.
Right. Did you hear Sam says hee-haw, but did you hear one of the other boys screams at him?
He said something about slavery.
He says, go to work, slave.
Yes.
And then someone else screams, don't worry, we'll take care of it. You know, so I don't know what they're going to take care of.
No, I guess they're going to have to find their own third baseman somewhere else.
It's very possible.
And we get tossed into that corner. Now, I do have a question about the architecture here as we're getting thrown into the drugstore. Most of the architecture that I remember from this era, I mean, maybe this is an older building or something, but corner drugstores used to have a corner door. There'd be there'd be a column on the corner of the intersection of two streets, and you'd have to go around a pole to get into the store. But this store apparently didn't have, or maybe it used to, and they closed it off, and it faces one street.
Right.
It's just I found it an unusual door, but you know, maybe this was just a rehab of some other
place. I'm assuming that that's what it was. They apparently said, okay, it doesn't need to be the corner. It's located on the corner, but you don't have to have the door in the corner.
Yeah. Great door too. I mean, it makes the kids, these outsized doors, they look like they're two stories tall. It makes the kids look that much tinier. Yeah. I think everything in this scene is a little bit oversized to make the kids look even smaller than they are. The high stools, the high bar, even just all the countertops.
Right, but is it to make the kids look smaller, or to make it seem as if this is, you know, supposed to be a hangout for adults, you know, but only kids are showing up there?
Yeah. It's and it's also an element of memory. I think it's like when you remember being a little kid, you remember everything being like a lot larger. When people visit their old homesteads, they're like, I don't remember it being this small. It's like, well, you weren't that big when you were there.
I used to go back and visit my old elementary school, and I would go there and I'd be, you know, the urinals are so tiny. Yeah, it's like,
How do they ever fit in a desk?
That's right,
like this?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's an interesting view, and we get to, he gets thrown into the drugstore, and then we get introduced to the world of early 20th century pharmacies.
That's right.
Which, you know, had everything from ice cream to cigars. But it's beautiful. It's so many gadgets and widgets and things to freeze frame on in this. I'm sure you have a couple.
Yeah, just a few.
I just wanted to point out one thing.
But go ahead, you can start.
Yeah. I love. There's a in the background we see some of the most popular cigarettes of the day, Chesterfields and Camels, arranged in alternating titles. Anybody who listened to Dragnet, the radio version of Dragnet, would know Chesterfield cigarettes. Jack Webb was pushing them all the time. Camel cigarettes being one of those popular brands of the 1940s, right after Lucky Strike, because Lucky Strike basically had more users because they were included in Army K rations. You got a little package of maybe four cigarettes.
Right, but that was but that's already 20 years later. You know, this is only 1990.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
they didn't get that government contract.
That's right. They don't have that yet. And you also can see a box that says on it La Única.
La Única, the only one in Spanish.
Which do you know what that is?
Only one. Yeah. It should be a box of cigars. Right. I think they originally they were originally a Cuban blend, and then the seeds were moved to Dominican Republic.
Correct.
And currently, you can buy a newer version of La Unica. They're no longer Cuban, but they are now Dominican Republic. But they're supposed to be hand rolled cigarettes.
Right. I think in like the 80s
or cigars. Right.
I think in the 80s that's when they started remanufacturing them. And then you know, George, we get two seconds of a girl sitting on a stool. You know, we don't yet know who that is. She will play a very important part in this movie. And then George goes over to some strange little contraption, which I'm sure Jim can now tell us what that contraption is. You probably know all the history of this specific contraption.
I do know that it is a Spark Gap cigar lighter. And it was made in Davenport, Iowa by the Spark Gap lighter. It ran on a variety of fluids. It ran on everything from kerosene to gasoline.
Yeah.
What it is there was a small dry cell battery, a 6-volt battery in the base. And as we watch George as he makes a wish on this device, he pulls down on the little latch there, and it kicks off a spark from the 6-volt battery that ignites whatever lighter fluid he was using at the time to light your cigar. Yeah. I would imagine that the cigar would have a petroleum taste if it was a liquid, you know, dribbling out of the top. It was like as you pulled it down, it activated a pump that pumped just enough fuel into that little handle there, or above the handle, like a little fountain above the handle. It would light that and give you long enough to puff on the cigar to get it going. But rather dramatic. And
do you think people really needed these? That, I mean, they used it that much. Couldn't you just find an easier way to light up a cigar?
Yeah, well, I mean, you didn't want to wind up with a match or anything like that.
God forbid.
And it probably, and it was pretty dramatic. It was a pretty dramatic thing to have. And these things, from what I've been reading, they were almost ubiquitous. I mean, they were like every place that sold cigars, you had one of these things. They're available. I mean, I've seen them on eBay and all kinds of different auction houses. But you can buy them today. I don't know if they. I mean, I would imagine the batteries are long dead. But if you ever wanted
I actually found online a whole bunch of refurbished ones that you can buy anywhere. They range anywhere between $400 and $1,000. I mean, I'm assuming that there are even more expensive ones that you can get there also. I even found a video on YouTube of someone explaining how it works. You know, but people should just listen to the way that Jim O'Kane explains it. It's much better. You know, because I saw in a picture that there were like three batteries inside. Or something like that.
Yeah. There's different configurations. This thing went through multiple improvements as cigar lighting technology improved over the years. But they were like Bic pens or anything. It was like you found them everywhere. I and other than this movie, I've never seen one in person.
No. Everywhere I looked online about this, it mentions like you saw in It's a Wonderful Life. It's like that's the only place where you can actually see one. You know, this is 1946, so you know that.
Yeah,
weren't using them as much in 46. You know, it was something that was much more popular in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah. By then Zippos had come around. So
no, I think Zippos. I think you and I actually even talked about this a long time ago. Could it have been on the greatest day? Have we talked about Zippos?
Yeah.
And
I think
one second. They had them in World War II. You're right.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking, if you have one of these things, you probably should and you want to put it on some auction site or something like that. Wait until December and wait for them to start showing this on marathons on different cable channels, and then you say, hey, as you saw in last night's movie.
That's right.
But it's funny how impressive. I mean, this is one of those things, when you see this movie when you're a kid, it's like this is one of the memorable scenes. You say, what is that, and why do I want one so much?
Even if I don't smoke cigars.
Yeah. This is, I could start, you know, this is just, I just want to hold my hand up and make a wish.
Right. And do you, I mean, I couldn't find any information about this, but where do you think the idea comes from that you make a wish on that?
You can make a wish on a star. You can make a wish on anything. My dad used to make a wish on a bale of hay. If you're driving down the, you know, driving on the highway and you saw a truckload go by full of hay, he said, make a wish on a bale of hay.
And okay. I'm
like, okay, Dad.
Right. And then also, you know, he makes this wish and he, first of all, you know, they always say that if you're going to make a wish, you're not supposed to make it out loud because then it won't come true, which we'll talk about later in this movie. But, you know, the idea here is he just tells everybody his wish is that he wants $1 million. You know?
Yeah.
How much do you think $1 million in 1919 is worth in 2023?
I would guess maybe 20 times that. Maybe it's worth $20 million.
$19,747,000.
Oh.
Sorry.
Oh, well.
You were over by two and a half million.
Well, by Price is Right rules, I was wrong. Yes.
Yeah, for some reason, I thought it was even higher, but still, $17 million. He's asking for $17 million. You know,
in cash. And where was it going to be delivered? He really should have, you know, listed this out, especially if, you know, he's going to be visited people. But it was, he did his best, and he didn't seem disappointed. Yeah, it lit up when he made his wish. So to him,
that's
a win.
Do you think that this is something that didn't always light up, and that was the issue? You know, it's like the idea that if I flip the switch and it doesn't and it lights up, then they don't get my wish. You know, is it something that didn't always work?
that's what I'm thinking. Maybe, you know, like Mr. Gower forgot to fill up the tank in the thing, and I would love to know. I'm going to have to look up that YouTube video because I want to know how you fill it up. It looks like it would have a sizable reservoir, or maybe it's.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea. That I did not check. I didn't check to see how much you got
battery.
There.
And
as he does this, he also screams out "hot dog," which, as everyone who's been listening to the show already for the last week, they know that's the tagline at the end of every episode. But I couldn't find any reason for that exclamation. You know, everything I looked up with hot dog is basically just talking about the Frankfurter, you know. the only things that I found that were different is in freestyle skiing that it can sometimes be called
a hot dog skier.
Tennis. Sometimes you can call someone a hot dog in tennis. There's an HTML editor named Hot Dog. In the Archie comics, Jughead's dog was named Hot Dog. And I found this and I said, this is for Jim. There is an astronomy relation to the word hot dog. You have any idea what it is?
Does it have something to do with Canis Major or Sirius?
Hot dog is a hot, dusted, obscured galaxy.
Ah, okay. That I did. There's my new thing for today.
I'm always glad when I'm able to teach Jim O'Kane things, especially about space and astronomy and stuff like that. You know,
the stuff you learn on this show is amazing.
Of course, that's the way. That's why we're here.
Wow. Making the world a better place.
Always.
Wow. So he does get through. He does say hot dog, which I guess maybe he'll settle for a hot dog if he didn't get $1 million. Maybe that could be.
Yeah. And he's really happy. He starts whistling and starts walking
maybe
off.
Maybe he wanted a hot dog.
Maybe he wanted to make a hot dog at that point. You're saying.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I don't want $1 million. I really want lunch.
Okay. Maybe. Could be. Yeah. And then he screams to Mr. Gower and he goes, it's me, Mr. Gower, George Bailey. Who else could it be?
Yeah. Some other George. Yeah.
And who's been manning the store since then? If, you know, because Gower's is in the back, you know, you leave it open. You think he should have come out to see what Mary wanted because she's sitting on the stool, you know, unless he looks at his watch and says, George will be here in 10 minutes. You know, just let her wait.
Yeah, he might have told her just, you know, wait there. I'll have my boy is late, and you know, as soon as they crack the whip into the front, I'll have him here.
That's right. And then Gower screams, "You're late!" And he goes, "Yes, sir."
Yes, we get to see our first view of the great H.B. Warner, which this is such a departure from everything he's done in the past. He played Jesus Christ in the silent films. And most recently, he had worked for Capra as the guy that pretty much ran Shangri-La, Chang.
That's right.
Ronald Coleman's guide.
In Lost Horizon. Yes.
Yeah.
Apparently, he was offered this role because Capra knew that he, you know, usually H.B. Warner had starrier roles. And he decided to, you know, he offered him this role, and he said, well, if Capra's giving me this role, I'm going to take it. And, you know, this is probably one of the things that he's most remembered for.
Wow. Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, he's completely set against type there. He's an amazing actor. I can't remember him in a role that I didn't love him in. Even in here, he's just you totally buy that he's this, you know, addled pharmacist who's, you know, working out some issues that have just come up.
That's right. But we also, and we get to see through the glass, we get to see that he has a bottle of booze in his hand, you know, and picks it up.
Nice little flask there.
That's right.
One thing I do want to point out, it's on the, you know, stuff in the background as George is clocking in. There is, besides the classic Pepto-Bismol, the big pink bismuth jars, there is a stack of Penetro cough syrup. And Penetro's, it's supposed to calm down your cough. Its primary ingredient was chloroform. And it's like you could buy 6 ounces of pretty much solid chloroform, you know, or you could, to use my reference point, you could pour it in a handkerchief and kidnap Jenny and from the Rocketeer. But yeah, it was you could actually go in and buy a bottle of chloroform to calm that kid. You know, your kids will sleep all night after a dose of Penetro cough syrup.
Oh wow!
But just a just a nice little thing to see on the shelf there next to the Pepto.
Yeah, no, I see it. Definitely see it.
Yeah,
I didn't notice it beforehand, but you're right. This was one shot that I didn't look to see what was going on in the back, but you're right. That is definitely you can see that. I did not know that. See, now you taught me something today, Joe. So there you go. We're even so far.
and the underneath Mr. Garrow,
Mr. Gower.
Underneath Mr. Gower, hard to say it quickly. But underneath him is a sign for Gets It Corn Remover.
Yeah.
Which was salicylic acid, currently sold as things like Compound W and stuff. It's basically a wart remover, just more powerful.
Just for 35 cents also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what a deal. it's probably, you know, and it's right there, and doesn't have any chloroform in it either, as far as I can tell.
You know, 35 cents back then is worth $6.21 today.
Wow. Well, I guess it depends on how much you want to get rid of those corns.
That's right.
Wow. So poor Mr. Gower is dealing with some issues.
Yeah. We'll have to find out. We'll find out tomorrow what those issues are. And then.
Yeah. And now I do have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is Mr. As we meet Mr. Gower, do you think he's always been like this, or did he just find new reasons to be like this?
I think he was borderline beforehand, and this pushed him over the edge. That's what I think. Because otherwise he wouldn't have had that flask around. You know. It's not something that you say. Hey, you don't wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm gonna, you know, take a flask to work, or
yeah,
you know,
he's obviously been drinking early, but it's I was just wondering if, like, did people generally know him for being hard to live with and hard, you know, like always dour Mr. Gower.
I don't think so. But, my assumption is not. You know, but what do you think? Do you think he is?
I don't know. I mean, he might have been like ornery, but not too ornery.
Exactly.
And this is just I think this is just he's cranked up a bit.
Yeah. Right.
So,
and then the shot changes, and we see a little girl running into the store. And then as she gets to the door, she like slows herself down. which I think is also great because it shows it makes us feel as if this girl, who we will find out shortly, her name is Violet, that she basically knows what time George shows up, and therefore she wants to make sure she's there. And she's running, running, and then she stops herself and wants to nonchalantly just walk into the door. Like, oh, I just happened. Oh, what a surprise.
What
George
do,
is
what
here.
What do you know? And she's got, I've been trying to figure out when she comes in a rather, her outfit seems to be more, she doesn't look as frumpy as Mary does. She seems more stylish. And it's not like she's got like a pinafore collar and stuff. She seems to have a little bit more pizzazz than Mary, who has kind of a plain collar.
Well, we see that throughout the rest of the movie. I mean, the whole movie, there is that contrast between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just interesting how they set it up.
That even at even at this point, it shows the type of family she comes from. You know, she comes from a family who will make sure that she has nice clothes to wear all the time.
Yeah, yeah. She dresses to impress.
That's right.
And Mary's doing what she can. She put, you know, she found a fancy ribbon to put it in her hair. And this doesn't seem like the first time Mary and Violet have competed about anything.
That's right.
Mary definitely has an opinion, as you can tell from her face.
Yes, and tomorrow they will talk even more about it.
Yeah.
And then basically we get the two lines from Violet, and she goes, "Hello, George. Hello, Mary." And then she basically gets cut off at the end of this minute.
Yeah, yeah. She lands those two. It's like she's like, "Hello, George," and then to Mary, it's just very perfunctory. It's like,
"That's
yes,
right.
I acknowledge looking, you're here."
She's looking at George, and she like looks over her shoulder at. She's looking directly at George and over her shoulder at Mary.
Yeah, yeah. So. It's definitely it's an unspoken rivalry,
yeah.
Or at least. Mm-hmm. Mary speaks her rivalry. We'll find out about that more tomorrow.
That's right.
I think Violet's a little bit more in the aggressive camp on this thing. She's definitely on a mission, but we're kind of getting ahead of
That's
ourselves
right.
and all that.
That's right. Okay. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into today's segment?
No, I'm cool with this.
All right. Great. So every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra films. So, Jim, start with your number five and work your way up.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington would be my number five. I don't have it under my Jimmy Stewart's later on. We'll talk this week, but it's so over the top Capra. It's just, if you wanted to point out what's a Capra movie, like you throw in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's got Jimmy Smith. It is
Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Smith. Jimmy Stewart. Excuse me.
Jimmy Smith is not there.
Yeah, no, not LA Jimmy Law. Smith. Yeah, yeah. No, it's he. You know, I know he was president of the Republic and all. No, but the, but I know. It's Mr. Smith. That's what I was thinking.
That's right.
Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart at his Jimmy Stewartist Stewart. Est.
Right.
He's the most Jimmy Stewart you can be in a single movie. And he's, you know, he's this total Boy Scout or whatever they called it, Forrest. I forget what they called it in the movie, but he's like extreme Boy Scout. He's showing bird calls and he winds up running and becoming a senator and being put in the Senate. And, you know, then he's up against all the machination. You know, it's like a room full of potters and he has to
a
deal
room full of
with,
potters before evil. Potter.
Yeah, yeah, it's and, you know, and he's got to deal with evil Claude Rains, and not in a nice, not in the nice, you know, Captain Renault kind of Claude Rains. He's just a bad guy, but you know, there's all kinds of machinations going on, and he just he's completely naive and gets suckered into things. He has Jean Arthur falling in love with him, and it's every element you can think of that you can throw into a Capra movie. It's right there, all just in, I think it's 98 minutes or something. Nice short movie. You can sit and have the Liberty Bell rung at you. So I enjoy that film. But I have to go with other ones. You Can't Take It With You is, I'm putting that at number four, but it is one of my favorite Capra films. You Can't Take It With You is a lot of zaniness. It's like watching the Addams Family. It's just this crazy family. It has one of the better movies featuring Lionel Barrymore as the good guy.
Right.
And Lionel Barrymore is like the grandpa of the picture. Jane Withers being his artistic daughter who's dancing around. Everybody in this house kind of lives in their own world. And again, it's the little guy fighting against these real estate developers who want to tear down their house in Midtown Manhattan and build a giant place and destroy their neighborhood and their way of life. So it's just kooky, crazy, and lots of great jokes. There's a Russian bomber guy who likes building fireworks and things, and it's just and crazy inventions. Dub Taylor's in it. You can't not like a movie with Dub Taylor in it. So I put that in there. I would say, this is a tough one. And You Can't Take It With You is also a stage play, much like my other one of his favorites, which would be Arsenic and Old Lace. Arsenic and Old Lace is it's really one of the perfect look behind you kind of horror comedy movie. There's the fantastic characters all based on the stage play. You've got any movie that could have a guy that looks like Boris Karloff and a guy who thinks he's Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right.
In the Charge. Same movie. Yeah, Charge, the Panama Canal, dead bodies in a basement, poisoned elderberry wine, two crazy ants who are in the middle of it all is Cary Grant, who is he's the organizing sensibility, except he realizes that everybody in his family is crazy. And just watching him discover the kind of hijinks that have been going on in his aunt's house in Brooklyn, it's perfect. If you're looking for a perfect Halloween story, Arsenic and Old Lace fits the bill every time. And then it's got Peter Lorre in it, for heaven's sake. I'd say watch that. Getting away from comedies, I want to say Lost Horizon. Lost Horizon is a classic James Hilton's novel brought to the screen. Beautiful lush scenery, a very magical story. Again, we've got H.B. Warner, you've got Jane Wyatt, you've got Ronald Coleman, of course, in just one of his most unforgettable roles. And it's this place that Shangri-La became such a term that was used by everybody, even Franklin Roosevelt, when during the bombing of Tokyo right after Pearl Harbor, people asked him where did the planes take off from, and he said our secret base in Shangri-La. So it was a popular term, and it's become part of our culture now. But watching this movie, it's so much better than the 1973 Burt Bacharach musical with Bobby Vann in it. make sure when you're downloading this, renting it, or whatever. Make sure you get the right version. It's the 1937 version. There's also been a lot of cut scenes from it that I think they removed something like 20 minutes to make it more sellable.
And you just see the pictures.
Yeah, you just see still pictures, or they'll have very. I think they found in South America they found some 16mm prints and just tried to restore some of it. So a lot of it's been added back into the film. Edward Everett Horton's in it. Thomas Mitchell, who comes from my hometown of Elizabeth, New Jersey. It's just the character actors in it are fantastic. I don't think you can watch this movie and not love it. It's just you fall into these characters. You really go with the plot really doesn't matter that much. You can just feel all the interactions going on, and it has a lot of philosophy to it. It has a really solid heart. It's Capra at his best storytelling.
Yeah.
To me, that's one of his best ones. My favorite movie, only because I wrote my master's thesis on it, is Capra's last movie. A lot of people haven't seen this. There's a really bad video transfer of it on YouTube. In 1964, Frank Capra, in 1962, he was hired by Martin Marietta Corporation to sell the idea of a reusable space plane. And this was all going to be part of the New York World's Fair in 1964 and 1965. It was going to be the centerpiece of the New York Hall of Science's display of rocket technology. And it was shown there. The name of the movie was called Rendezvous in Space. If you watch the movie, you will see a rendezvous in space between a spaceship and a space station. While it was shown during the World's Fair, 7 million people saw this movie.
Wow.
Two of the people who saw this in 1964 were two guys that were working on their own science fiction movie, and they got the idea of using Frank Capra was, if anything, he was very cheap, so he always used public domain in his later movies. He used public domain music, so he dropped in classical music on top of this rendezvous between a winged spacecraft and a space station. The two people watching the movie, Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, got the idea, hey, maybe we should have that in our movie. So when 2001 was made, that scene comes from Frank Capra's Rendezvous in Space.
Oh, wow.
It's something to see. It's a very difficult to explain movie if you're not sitting in the audience while this is going on, because at the time when the rendezvous actually takes place, when the ship docks with the space station, the entire theater would go dark, and above people's heads there would be a real mock-up of a space station and two winged spacecraft, each weighing 3,000 pounds, would be moved around on the ceiling by giant winch motors. At the end of the movie, they would lower those spacecraft down so the people in the audience could look at them. My thesis was about how that movie affected everything from the Apollo-Soyuz mission between the Soviet Union and the United States in 1975 to placement of the door that runs the adapter on the International Space Station that's flying over your head right now if you're listening in 2023.
Oh, wow.
This movie is relatively unknown, but it had a lot of impact on the future, on the next 50 to 60 years in space. And it's still, you know, it still has echoes in future space flights. So it's an interesting one to see. It's out there on YouTube, Rendezvous in Space, Frank Capra.
And
so those are my five.
I see that the you know, you have Jim Backus, Mel Blanc, Danny Thomas.
Yes.
I mean, you have some great names that are uncredited there.
Wow. Yeah. They're Danny Thomas acts as kind of the man on the street interview. He had Sid Melton, who was he was Ralph in Green Acres, Ralph and Alf. He was Alf. Ralph was his sister. Sid Melton's in it. And Danny Thomas talks about in the future, we'll have satellites whizzing over our head. And if you're in Patagonia and you want to call home, you can just reach in your pocket and pull out your pocket phone and call anywhere in the world. This was 1964.
Oh, wow.
So it's quite a thing to see. So if you have time, go to YouTube and watch this, because it's a very unusual but worthwhile thing to see.
Well, Jim, you now know that I'm going to be watching that in the next day or so.
Okay.
So,
well, good. I'm
be prepared to read a review of it.
I look forward to your review.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thank you very much for that. So, Jim, you want to tell people where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Real easy. You can find me at jimokane.com. JIMOKANE. Leave out the apostrophe. Because it doesn't work the other way, and you can find all my other podcasts, all my video ramblings, and where you can find me on Facebook and stuff. It's all there, jimokane.com, and I'm a frequent guest on a lot of the Movie by Minutes shows. You can find those at moviesbyminutes.com. So just keep looking around. Eventually, you'll find one of my guest episodes.
Here, so far, you know, in all six seasons, you can find five episodes of Jim on this show. Well, actually, as of today, you'll only find one of this season. But
yes,
stay
tuned. Yes,
that's right. All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly, dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.